From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, the creation of an American demagogue. We talk with Jeff Gwynn, author of a new book about cult leader Jim Jones, who developed his following as an itinerant preacher, faith healer, and social activist, and exhibited the classic tendencies of the demagogue.
You take current events and you exaggerate them to create a sense of fear and urgency. You tell everyone that you are the only person who can possibly lead them out of this danger.
In 1978, Jones led about 900 of his followers to kill themselves by drinking cyanide-laced punch. Also, we hear from Saturday Night Live cast member Sasheer Zamata.
My name's not actually from any island or African culture. It's from Star Trek.
Zamata has a new comedy special. And David Bianculli reviews the new season of Better Call Saul, the spinoff of Breaking Bad. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. If you've ever asked yourself, why would someone follow a demagogue? Stick around. My guest journalist Jeff Gwynn has written a new book about Jim Jones, the preacher, faith healer, civil rights activist, socialist, cult leader who attracted thousands of followers in what he called the People's Temple. Gwynn says Jones exhibited the classic traits of a demagogue. Gwynn's new book is called The Road to Jonestown. Jonestown was the name of the mission Jones set up in the mid-1970s in the jungle of Guyana, where he led nearly 1,000 of his followers, fleeing from what he said were the imminent threats of martial law in America, concentration camps, and nuclear war. The isolation of Jonestown also gave him more total control over his followers. He had such control, he was able to lead his followers to commit mass suicide by drinking a cyanide-laced powdered fruit punch. 900 people died in that mass murder-suicide. 300 of them were children. Jones died of a gunshot wound in the head. In a couple of minutes, we'll hear an excerpt of the audio recording that was made as Jones urged his followers to end their lives. Jeff Gwynn's previous book is the bestseller Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff Gwynn, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm not going to assume that people know much about the People's Temple or Jim Jones, so can you just give us a brief overview of what this cult was? And I think it's fair to describe it as a cult.
Jim Jones originally organized People's Temple as a storefront church in Indianapolis in the late 1940s and early 1950s. It became one of the first major mixed-race churches in that part of the country, and Jones was instrumental in integrating Indianapolis, which had been one of the most segregated cities in America. They later moved to California. The purpose of People's Temple, as stated, was to feed the hungry, clothe the needy, ostensibly to try to raise up all the people who had been left out by society. Privately, within their organization, within their meetings where no outsiders were allowed, they also talked about what they were trying to do was set a socialist example. Everyone treated the same, where race, money, nothing mattered, human dignity was at a premium, and Jones preached to his followers that if they would live in this socialist way as he led them, the rest of the world would be so overwhelmed by the goodness of what they were doing that everyone would live the same way ultimately. They were not ever going to try to take over a government or a nation by revolt or violence. They intended to do it by example.
But there was a real dark side to this. You're talking about the idealistic side, but the reality of what was going on is that he claimed to be God. He had total control over people's lives. He had them donate everything that they had and move them or move those willing to follow him. And it was just like under 1,000 people who came with him to the jungle of Guyana, where there was no way out. They carved out a little part of the jungle for their village. I want to cut to the end of the Jim Jones story, and then we'll tell the whole story in more detail. The story ends with him not only assuming complete control of their lives, but complete control of their deaths. Describe the death that he orchestrated for everybody in his cult who was living with him in the jungle in Guyana.
By the end, in November 1978, Jones's attitude towards his followers had changed. In the early stages of his ministry, when actually great things were often being accomplished, he thought of himself as the shepherd guarding his flock. More and more over the years, as his paranoia increased, as his drug use increased, he began to think of himself at war with almost everyone else in the outside world, the United States government, all kinds of secret forces. He believed, he talked himself into believing that at any moment he would be attacked, he would be brought down. And he passed this along to his followers. At the end, he saw himself as a general, and his followers were his troops. And when Jones made the decision that there must be one last great gesture so that his name would live in history, his example would live in history, that would require the deaths of his followers.
So the expression about drinking, like he drank the Kool-Aid, like he went along with it, comes from Jonestown, but it wasn't Kool-Aid. It was another kind of punch.
Flavor-Aid was a cheap Kool-Aid knockoff. And in Jonestown, they lived only on the basics. Kool-Aid would have been too much of a luxury.
So there is actually a tape, about a 40-minute tape, of the final chapter in the People's Temple's history, when he's convincing his followers that it's time to commit this revolutionary act. It's not suicide. It's a revolutionary act. And you hear him convincing people that they need to go along and drink this punch. And then he says, are there any dissenters? And some people say, well, you told us that we could have a home in Russia if things fail here. So, like, let's try the Russia option. And he says, no, that's not going to work. And he explains why that's no longer going to work. And then you hear other people, like, saying that they don't want to die. But then you hear people, and we'll hear some of this in the excerpt we're going to hear, you hear people thanking him and praising him and saying that they owe their lives to him. So let's hear some of the final moments in this surviving tape just before the members of this cult drink the poisoned punch.
We're not letting them take our life. We're laying down our life. Taking their lives. We just want peace.
All I'd like to say is that my so-called parents was filled with so much hate. And treachery. I think you people out here should think about how your relatives was and be glad about that the children are being laid to rest. And all I like to say is I thank Dad for making me strong to stand with it all and make me ready for it. Thank you.
Talking to them, all they're doing is taking a drink to take to go to sleep. That's what death is, sleep. But of it, I'm tired of it all. We used to sing this world's not our home. Well, it sure isn't. As we were saying, it sure wasn't. Yeah. He doesn't want to tell them. All he's doing, if they will tell them, assure these children. Can some people assure these children of the relaxation of stepping over to the next plane? We've set an example for others. We've set 1,000 people who say we don't like the way the world is. Take our life from us. We laid it down. We got tired. We didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide protesting the conditions of an inhumane world.
So that's some of the final moments of the Jonestown cult and of the so-called death tape. And, you know, there's parts of this tape where you hear babies crying in the background and you know soon, like, they're going to be dead. But I think it must give a sense of how devoted these people were to him, that they're about to kill themselves because he said they should, and they're thanking him. Thank you, Dad.
One of the things that's hardest for us to understand now, looking back almost 40 years, is how almost 900 people, actually a few over 900, could have followed what appear to be ridiculous orders from an obvious demagogue to kill themselves. But it's much more complicated than that. First of all, not everybody in Jonestown that day did agree to die, to drink the poison. We have to begin with, out of over 900 human beings, 300 children, many of them infants. They have no choice. Their parents are making the choice for them. Then we have another third who are elderly people who aren't in the best of health, who, if they don't follow Jim Jones's orders, are going to be left out in the deepest, densest, most dangerous jungle in the world. Their choices essentially are die quickly or die long, lingering deaths. In the middle, you have the adults, the younger people, and even among them, there's no unanimity. Some do believe that Jim Jones is God or something close to God, and they worship him. And if he says do this, they're going to. Others don't believe Jones is a god, but they believe in their cause, and they have bought into his preaching that the rest of the world is coming in to get them. He's announced, just before bringing out the Flavor Aid laced with cyanide, that a congressman has been murdered, and that means that the attack from the outside, the Americans, probably the Guyanese government, will come any minute. They're going to slaughter us and take away our children. Isn't it better that we do this ourselves? We have this one last act of defiance.
My guest is Jeff Gwynn, author of the new book, The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and People's Temple. We'll hear more of the interview after a break, and TV critic David Bianculli will review the new season of Better Call Saul. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, for more than 20 years helping consumers select local service providers, dedicated to promoting fairness and transparency about local pricing and quality at angieslist.com. Angie's List, home is where our heart is. And from Stitch Fix, an online personal styling service for women and men. Clients fill out a style quiz, then a personal stylist sends hand-picked pieces straight to their door. Learn more at stitchfix.com.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeff Gwynn, author of the new book, The Road to Jonestown, about the cult leader Jim Jones, who Gwynn describes as having the classic tendencies of a demagogue. Well, as you point out, some demagogues appeal to people's darker nature, like Hitler or Charles Manson. But initially, Jones really appealed to people's ideals, social justice, integration, civil rights. And so people like initially followed him because he seemed to be an idealistic man. He became politically connected. People admired the work that he was doing. He helped integrate the Indianapolis schools, but at the same time, he was a con man pretty early on. He became a Methodist minister. His wife was Methodist, and he briefly took on her religion. Then he became an itinerant preacher and psychic and faith healer. Let's get to some of that. During his early, like, healings, what did he do to convince people that he was performing these miraculous healing acts?
Jim Jones was a tremendous performer. Instinctively, he understood the things that he would need to do in front of a crowd, not just to get their attention, but to hold it and be remembered by them. He taught himself and then taught a few followers how to assist him. And in the book, I think readers are going to be amazed by how brilliantly he would concoct being able to summon cancers from people's bodies, which were actually rotten chicken parts that he would have planted earlier. And even then, as he starts to gain a following through these apparent miracles, he has a number of followers who are well aware. Well, it's a trick. But they tell themselves, Jim is doing what he has to do to bring people in for the greater good, because at the same time, he is doing these terrible things, he's making things up, he's tricking people. He is also out there working for integration, for civil rights, for women's rights. And that is his argument. I need to do whatever is necessary to get people into the cause. After that, we can all accomplish great things. This is what demagogues do. The difference, and this staggered me because there's proof of this time and again. Almost all demagogues, and you mentioned Hitler, you mentioned Manson, appeal to the worst side of their potential followers. They simply think if together they can represent the best in humanity, then everyone else will want to follow suit voluntarily. At the same time, more and more, they have to forgive Jim Jones's excesses. Okay, maybe he said something that wasn't true. So what? Maybe he's having sex with women within the group besides his wife. What can you do? That doesn't matter besides the great mission. And of course, this is what makes Jim Jones perhaps the most effective demagogue in modern American history, because he can convince people that if outsiders are in any way attacking or criticizing him, then what they're really doing is criticizing the great mission, the thing that is bigger than any individual.
I want to get back to the faith healing for a moment. So I'll read a flyer that you reprint from a Chicago event that he was holding. The most miraculous spiritual healing ministry in the land today. Reverend Jones often calls scores of people from the audience who are healed of all manner of disease. The blind see, the deaf hear, the cripples walk. Hear his urgent liberation message for these troubled times. See miracles, signs, and wonders that God is manifesting through Reverend Jim Jones. And he once resurrected himself. He faked his own death and then revived himself. I mean, tell us a little bit about that.
Jones, as most demagogues are, was a gifted entertainer. Now, the flyer you just read, what would happen when Jim Jones got a lot of his temple followers, they would get in their fleet of a dozen Greyhound buses, and they would cross the country going into all the big cities, Chicago, Seattle, Portland. He never really got out to the East Coast too much. He was aware that the media there was, shall we say, skeptical. But the whole idea was they would distribute these flyers, not in the well-to-do parts of town. They would go into the ghettos, into the public housing, where people have absolutely nothing. He understood that when you believe life is almost hopeless, that's when you're most ready to buy into some miracle that might lift you up. And so he would use the buses on the day of his program to go in to these lower income areas, give people free bus rides to the big auditorium where there would not only be food available, but he would have physicians who would check blood pressure, who would do tests for diabetes. there would be people on staff if some of these folks were having trouble getting set up for welfare or Social Security. Here are experts who can help you cut through the paperwork and do what it would take. And then finally you're seated. They had a world-class band. The music at Jim Jones meetings was just amazing. It'll beat almost anything you'd see on stage at a big concert hall. And then come the healings, with people apparently spitting out cancers, with the dead, occasionally even Father Jones himself, suddenly rising up at his command. So you get entertainment, but even more than that, you get hope. And so can it be any wonder that at every one of these stops, there are always some people who want to get on the bus and go on with Jim Jones and People's Temple? He understood psychology, and he took full advantage.
My reading of your book, and you can tell me if this is how you see it, is that beneath all of his idealism, maybe not initially, but certainly fairly soon, beneath all that idealism was this cynicism that he knew how to play people. He developed a very large African-American following and said something, I'm just going to paraphrase here, but said something to another of his followers that if you keep them poor and hungry, they'll always stay with you, you know, because they'll be in need.
I think part of the time Jim Jones was extremely cynical, but I also think there were other times that he pretty much talked himself into believing that he was something more than human and that it was necessary to do anything, and that pretty much means anything, to get enough followers that he can bring about these great acts, these great changes. And again, when we talk about the ways he was a charlatan, the way he was a cynic, the way he brutally took advantage of people who trusted him, the part we forget is that for so many years, Jim Jones and People's Temple were accomplishing great things. It's not an accident that Jones became so politically powerful out in California, to the point where Willie Brown, speaker in the California legislature, when he's introducing Jones at a testimonial dinner in Jones's honor, compares him to Martin Luther King, Mao, and even Gandhi. Jones had the ability to inspire people to do great things. That was offset by Jones's own fixation with his right to do whatever he personally wanted to do. Yes, he took advantage of his followers, and ultimately he sacrificed them to his own ego and his own belief in himself. That is unforgivable.
So you've been kind of living in the mind of Jim Jones for years as you research this. And so when you look around you now, living in the present, do you see any echoes of Jim Jones?
The things I've learned writing this book scare the hell out of me in terms of today's America. And as social media continues to expand, more and more people are getting unfiltered information that they can believe or not to believe. And we're entering a time in our history, I think, where a lot of people think the truth doesn't matter because the truth is always going to be just what's convenient for them to believe. The facts don't matter anymore. Leadership is less based on some sort of comprehensive plan to bring everyone together, but instead people want to gain control, want to gain power in office by splitting up the country and having just enough margin on their side to get sufficient votes to win. And once people are in power, instead of using it positively, it's used instead to try to emphasize their ties with their followers and to show disdain and even in some cases outright try to destroy anybody who disagrees with them. Jim Jones epitomizes the worst that can happen when we let one person dictate what we hear, what we believe, that anybody opposed to him must be opposed to us. This is what we're becoming. We can only change that if we learn from the past and try to apply it to today. So yes, the things I've learned writing this book scare the hell out of me.
Thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Jeff Gwynn is the author of the new book, The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and the People's Temple. After the major success of the AMC drama series Breaking Bad, series creator Vince Gilligan teamed with another of the show's writer-producers, Peter Gould, to make a spin-off series called Better Call Saul. Set mostly in the years prior to the Breaking Bad storyline, it follows the shady lawyer played by Bob Odenkirk, who in Breaking Bad went by the name of Saul Goodman. Better Call Saul launched its third season last Monday, telling more of the origin story of Jimmy McGill, who eventually becomes Saul Goodman. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, has this review.
You don't need to know all about Breaking Bad and the meth-making, drug-dealing former schoolteacher Walter White, played by Bryan Cranston, to enjoy Better Call Saul. This spin-off series more than stands on its own. And as TV spin-offs go, it's the best in the business since Cheers begat Frasier. Come to think of it, Better Call Saul has even reinvented and refreshed its storyline the same way the sitcom Frasier did, by giving the main character a brother and making sibling rivalry and similar occupational interests key to the new show's central dynamic. In Frasier, Kelsey Grammer as Frasier Crane was given the gift of David Hyde Pierce, playing high-strung younger brother Niles, a fellow psychologist. In Better Call Saul, Bob Odenkirk as Jimmy McGill is given the gift of Michael McKean, playing the even higher-strung older brother Chuck, a fellow lawyer. This addition to and expansion of the Breaking Bad canon has been one of its great triumphs and one of its best secret weapons. Chuck is a moral by-the-book attorney, while Jimmy is fine cutting corners. As we've learned over the past two seasons, Chuck has disapproved of Jimmy and his approach, and at the climax of last season, tricked Jimmy into confessing to having doctored some documents and secretly taped that confession. The new season premiere, written by series creators Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould and directed by Gilligan, picks up shortly after that. Jimmy finds an old childhood book in Chuck's house and gets uncharacteristically sentimental, until Chuck abruptly breaks the spell.
Mabel goes into the mountain and she meets the king of the brownies and he gives her some kind of super delicious jelly and holy crap, 1912.
Yeah, belonged to Grammy Davenport. She wrote her name in it. She was reading that to her school kids the year the Titanic went down.
Damn. And Mom read it to me.
I read it to you. You don't remember.
Yeah, yeah. I do now that you say it, yeah. What was I, like 5 or 6?
You had this weird nightlight that you were so crazy about. It was
Daffy Duck.
It was some Daffy Duck ripoff with this weird red
bill.
Yeah. And it used to get so hot, we thought it would burn the house down, but we wouldn't let anybody touch it.
Yes, you got a great memory, Chuck. The red bill and everything. Hey, what was the name of that little girl that lived 3 houses up from us? She had like a page boy haircut, and she was always in the dirt, always dirty.
Jimmy.
I liked her. She was
Jimmy. Don't think I'll ever forget what happened here today. And you will pay.
There's a similar tension between Jimmy and his girlfriend and law partner, Kim, played by Ray Seahorn. She dislikes Jimmy's unethical antics as well. She's another great character and performer that was added at the start of Better Call Saul. But there also are some classic carryovers. Foremost among them is Jonathan Banks as Mike Ehrmantraut, a former cop who was one of the standout players in Breaking Bad. This season, he's following a trail that leads, by episode 2, to a fast food chicken joint that Breaking Bad fans will recognize and be delighted by immediately. Hey, I said you don't have to know Breaking Bad to enjoy Better Call Saul, but you'll enjoy it even more if you do. When Mike sends Jimmy into Los Pollos Hermanos to order some food and act like a customer, Breaking Bad fans are waiting like crazy for a glimpse of Gus Fring, the chicken maven and drug kingpin played by Giancarlo Esposito. And that's exactly what we get of him at first, just a glimpse. Out of focus or only partly in frame, never seeing his face. It's like TV foreplay. But eventually, in that frighteningly polite voice, Gus Fring lives and talks again. As he quietly confronts Jimmy, who's rooting through one of the restaurant's garbage cans, for possible evidence.
Can I help you?
My watch clasp is loose. It falls. I tried to reach it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Allow me.
Yeah, they say a nice watch band is as important as the watch. That's what I get for cheaping out.
We'll find it for you.
Where the heck is it?
Oh, don't worry. If it's in here, I'll... Ah, there it is. Oh, may I clean this for you? We have alcohol wipes.
I know. It's been in worse places. Thank you. That was very nice of you.
No problem. It's my pleasure. Is there anything else I can do for you?
It's all character, it's all mood, and if you've been following Saul Goodman's story all this time, it's brilliant. Season 3, like the previous seasons, opens with a black-and-white sequence set after the events of Breaking Bad, when Saul, once Jimmy, is now hiding in plain sight as a man named Gene, the manager of a Cinnabon store in Omaha. The music played during this scene is the vintage Nancy Sinatra hit Sugartown, perfectly suited to a place with so much icing and sweetness. But Jimmy, Saul, Gene, none of them belongs there, and avoiding the past by toiling there will work for only so long. My dream, and my hope, is that eventually Better Call Saul will finish its flashback story of how Jimmy became Saul and switch to its post-Breaking Bad story of what happens to the poor guy next. It could be a prequel and a sequel in one, and give us not only a great origin story, but a fabulous new chapter as well. But since Better Call Saul already is the best drama series on TV, just as Breaking Bad was in its time, I'll happily settle for whatever time frame and episodes I can get.
David Bianculli teaches TV and film history at Rowan University, and is the author of The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. Coming up, we'll hear from Saturday Night Live cast member Sasheer Zamata. She has a new stand-up comedy special. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List. For more than 20 years, helping consumers select local service providers. Dedicated to promoting fairness and transparency about local pricing and quality. At AngiesList.com. Angie's List. Home is where our heart is. And from Stitch Fix, an online personal styling service for women and men. Clients fill out a style quiz. Then a personal stylist sends hand-picked pieces straight to their door. Learn more at StitchFix.com.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our next guest, Sasheer Zameda, has been a cast member on Saturday Night Live since 2014. Now viewers have a chance to see her own comedy act on a new stand-up special called Pizza Mind, which is on NBC's comedy streaming site, CISO. She also appears in the film Deirdre and Lainey Rob a Train, which just premiered on Netflix, and the film Slight, which will be released later this month. Zameda has a background in improv and performed with the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York City, where many comics have gotten their start. Listeners of This American Life might also know Zameda from her appearances on that show. Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado spoke with Sasheer Zameda. They started with an excerpt from her stand-up special in which she's telling the story behind her first name.
My name's not actually from any island or African culture. It's from Star Trek. My parents are Trekkies. Technically Trekkers, that's what the fans were called when the show first came out. And they were watching an episode together, season 2, episode 50. And Captain Kirk was flirting with this alien princess, as he does. And he gave her a rose and she goes, "Oh, we have something like this on my planet, except it's made out of crystal and it's called Sasheer." And my parents were like, "Yes! That'll be our daughter." And they gave each other a Vulcan high five and called it a night.
That's from the stand-up special Pizza Mind. Sasheer Zameda, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
You started in comedy doing improv. You even did it in college. But when you moved to New York, you did improv, you did sketch, and you started doing stand-up. What made you want to start doing stand-up comedy?
People in my improv classes were talking about trying stand-up, and the way they described it, they were all scared. They thought it was a big endeavor. And I like doing scary things, so I was like, "Well, I'll give it a try." And I did. I went to an open mic by myself, didn't tell anybody, wrote some jokes, and I didn't do awful. So I remember going on stage, doing my 5 minutes, and then I came off stage and sat next to another woman. She's like, "Great job." And I was like, "Thanks. That was my first time." And she's like, "Well, I couldn't even tell." And I was like, "This is my life forever. I can do this forever now." I just wanted to keep going and get better and learn how to tackle this thing that was new to me.
Your stand-up special, Pizza Mind, deals a lot with issues like racism and sexism. And I want to play another scene from Pizza Mind about an interaction you had with someone else who works on SNL who mistakes you for another African-American female comedian. Let's take a listen.
People also have a hard time telling black actresses apart. I was talking to somebody who works at SNL who's seen my face for years, and he asked me, "Didn't you work at The Daily Show before you worked here?" He was talking about Jessica Williams. Exactly, yeah. Okay, she's not here. No, she's great. Yeah, she was The Daily Show correspondent. She is my friend, and not me. She's not me. But I wanted to help this guy out. I was like, "Oh, well, I was in an Apple commercial. Maybe an Apple commercial aired during an episode of The Daily Show? And you got confused?" Which would have made him an idiot if that's what he thought, but it was still reaching. And he just looks at me and goes, "No, I don't think that's it," and walks away. Not knowing his mistake, and I got so mad at myself. I was like, "Why am I doing this? Why am I hemming and hawing trying to make the situation less awkward for the person who made it awkward? It's not my fault that he can't tell the difference between black women. That's on him. So I'm done. I'm not doing that anymore."
That's from the stand-up special Pizza Mind. I'm not sure if this exact thing happened, but I'm sure variations of this happen all the time. Did that really happen with a SNL coworker?
Oh, that's a real conversation, yeah. Yeah, I want to call out the person who said that, but yeah, it was surprising because it was like, "Really? You see my face all the time here and you thought that I worked at The Daily Show?" I mean, Yeah, and I really did try to dig him out of that hole for him. I was like, yeah, maybe an Apple commercial is where you saw me and you got confused. All of that was true. And I don't think he ever really realized what his mistake was.
What do you think that instinct is to try to make it easier for the person who's saying this to you? I mean, it's totally on the other person who made the mistake, but there is this instinct to try to make it nicer, easier for the other person.
I think because you, as soon as that person realizes that they have made a mistake that may be construed as ignorant or even racist, the conversation gets so awkward. And they may be a nice person. They may even be my friend. So there's like a little part of me that's like, oh, no. It's okay. I don't want you to feel bad. And it's kind of like,
you're not racist.
You know, yeah, trying to like coddle a scared kitten or something and be like, no, it's fine. It's like, we're all friends here. We're all okay. But then it's like, no, I don't have to do that. You should learn. You should just learn from your mistakes. You should feel that emotion. And if it feels awkward, and then don't do it again and actually be conscious of what you're saying next time. But yeah, I'm really over trying to make sure other people are comfortable in this conversation when they're making me uncomfortable. It's not my fault. That's something they need to work on.
Now, you were cast on SNL in 2014, and it may be one of the most visible SNL castings ever because it was at this time when SNL was criticized for lack of diversity and particularly for not having any women of color on the cast for a couple years. What was the casting process like for you from your perspective?
It was mostly odd because it was so public.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I had been auditioning for the show for a couple years before this point, and then they asked for a rushed showcase of black women in L.A. and in New York, and I was in the New York one. And then they chose people from those pools, and then I found out, like, after the holiday break. This was all in December.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it was very stressful. I mean, I didn't love it. I didn't mm-hmm. love that it was so public.
Well, had SNL been a goal of yours, like as a kid, did you watch the show and think, that's what I want to do, I want to do that?
Yeah, I watched SNL and Mad TV and Whose Line Is It Anyway, and didn't know how to get there at all. Didn't even know how the people who were there got there. And then when I got to college, I started doing improv, and then the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater has a touring company, and they go to colleges, and a group came to my college at UVA, and there was like a talk back between the college groups and the UCB team, and someone asked, how do you get a career in comedy? And Bobby Moynihan, who happened to be in the group, said, move to New York, go to UCB, and work really hard. And so I did that. And then and when I moved to New York, I didn't know how much improv and comedy would play into my life. I thought I was going to do theater and Broadway and stuff, but I kept going to see UCB shows, and I was just such a fan that I was like, I should just really try this, and dove in hard, started taking classes back to back, started taking sketch classes, and started doing stand-up all at the same time. And then eventually I was like, oh, this is all I want to do. This is all I want to dedicate my time to. And then eventually, my managers and agents saw me perform and signed me, and then I started getting money for it, and I was like, oh, this is even better now that I'm getting paid for it. And yeah, and then it turned into my career.
Do you have a favorite SNL sketch that you've worked on or that you loved performing in or writing?
This season, we did a sketch that was a Stranger Things parody, and I watched Stranger Things when it came out and loved it. And by the end of it, the biggest question I had was, where were Lucas's parents? The little black boy, his parents were nowhere, at least not anywhere searching for him. And I was like, if I was running around the woods looking for monsters late at night, my parents would be freaking out, and they would try to find me. I remember my mom would, like, rip me out of a Steak and Shake because I was out too late. So if I was, like, in danger, the consequences would be much greater. So I just wanted to put that in sketch form, and we have the performers for it, and Keenan and Lizzie, like, made wonderful, harsh parents. And, yeah, I was so happy with the way that came out.
Well, let's take a listen to that sketch. It's really funny. A sketch from earlier this season, which was a parody of the Netflix show Stranger Things. And you're playing the little African-American boy.
Yeah.
Lucas!
Oh, no. Oh, God. It's my parents.
Lucas, where the hell have you been? We haven't seen you in days.
What makes you think you can be out this late? Kids in this town are getting snatched up by kidnappers.
But it's not kidnappers, Mr. Sinclair.
Yeah, it's the Demogorgon.
A demo what?
It's a monster, and we're looking for it.
Lucas, I told you not to hang out with these little white kids.
But we have to find the Upside Down.
The what?
It's like the normal world, but it's scarier, and there's danger at every turn.
Baby, people who look like us already live in the Upside Down.
Let me put it to you this way, Lucas. You don't have to go looking for scary stuff. It's gonna find you.
That's a sketch from earlier this season, a parody of Stranger Things. Now, radio and podcast fans may also know you from your appearances on This American Life. You've been on a bunch of times. And
yeah,
some of them funnier, some of them poignant, but all great pieces that you worked on. And one great piece you did was for an episode where the theme was It Will Make Sense When You're Older. And in it, you talked to your mom about race. It's about your relationship. It's about how she was one of the first Black students to integrate a white junior high school in a small town in Arkansas during the civil rights era. I want to play a bit of the piece. Here, your mother is describing to you what it felt like to be one of those kids. And she talks about how she felt like she didn't ask for it. She didn't ask to be a trailblazer. And she felt really alone, like she didn't have anyone to talk to about the experience. And here you ask her to describe what her first day was like. And then that sort of cuts to, at the end of what she's saying, it cuts to a bit of your stand-up back. So let's listen.
There was a lot of cussing at us while we were sitting on the bus. And Mama had told us sit in the front of the bus so in case something happens, the bus driver is a witness. Well, he was just a witness to us getting cussed out every day. He did nothing. When we got off the bus, we stood outside the window of the office. So if there anything happened, then they could witness something happening to us. The person I remember standing in the window was Coach Collier, who later became principal. So he witnessed the kids throwing rocks at us. I remember I had on